Welcome to the Phoenix Cast, a podcast about cybersecurity, technology, and innovation issues in the military. We are your hosts, John,
Rich,
and Kyle.
Rich and I are U.S. Marines, and the opinions expressed on the cast are our own, not official military policy.
And the opinions expressed by me are also my own, not those of my employer or any other businesses I happen to be associated with.
For today's episode, we're joined by a pair of special guests, Jason Passwaters, CEO of Intel 471, and Mike DeBolt, Chief Intelligence Officer of Intel 471. Jason, Mike, thanks so much for coming on the cast. Could you give us a quick intro?
Sure. Thank you, and pleasure to be here. I'm really happy to be here. So I think I'll start real quick from the earlier days. I joined the Marine Corps right out of high school as an infantryman. My first duty station was Bahrain. I was security forces, so did that for about a year. Ended up at 29 Palms with 3rd LAR as an infantry scout. Towards the end of that first enlistment, I started to look at what my options were and made a lateral move into counterintelligence and HUMINT. That's where I spent, you know, the last two enlistments before I got out of active duty, at 2nd Intel and 3rd Intel Battalion. During that time, I tacked on the TSCM or Technical Surveillance Countermeasures MOS, and really got into the technical side of counterintelligence for a bit. But you know, my passion was always in cyber. To really, in an attempt to scratch that itch, at the time, this is probably 2005 to 2008. That's when I started to think about moving into the civilian sector because the Marine Corps was not really oriented towards cyber at that time. Ended up at the FBI, as a contractor doing network forensics and intrusion analysis and chasing down mainly the upper tier Russian, Eastern European cyber criminals. From there, went into the private sector. After about 4 or 5 years, and the rest is history. Today, I'm the CEO and founder at Intel 471. We're a cyber threat intelligence company with about 200 people across 14 countries or so, serving hundreds of Fortune 1000 type profile customers and government customers across pretty much all major industries and geographies in the world.
And I'm going to break in real quick with the acronym POLICE, LAR, Light Armored Reconnaissance, and HUMINT, Human Intelligence. Mike, over to you.
Awesome. Hey, thanks guys for having me. So I'm the Chief Intel Officer at Intel 471. I'm on the executive team. I get a chance to oversee almost 100 Intel professionals that we have on our team around the world, which is pretty cool. So I started here at Intel 471 about 6 years ago. I was really brought in to help build and scale the Intel department to where it's at today. And there's a whole story to that. I'm sure we're going to get to that shortly. But before that, my background is primarily law enforcement at the federal and international level, and also counterintel as well. So just before coming to Intel 471, I was at Interpol in Singapore, where I was a U.S. representative there to help build out their very nascent cyber program over there, helping to support 190 member countries around the world. So I was there for a couple of years. Prior to that, I was an NCIS agent. So I was a special agent focused on cyber counterintelligence, national security operations for about 8 years in the Virginia area. And it was at that time where I really sunk my teeth into really the financially motivated cybercrime world, because at NCIS, naturally, everyone is really concerned about Russia, China, Iran, hostile states who are going after our secrets. And so a lot of the special agents, 1811s and others there, were obviously focused on chasing ghosts, as we called it, and trying to prevent that from happening. And I looked around and realized that no one's really focused on the cyber criminal threat to the DoD. And it was at that point that I stood up NCIS's first undercover operation that really targeted and focused on tracking cyber criminals who were impacting the DoD. So that was really the first time that I got introduced into this financially motivated cyber underworld, if you will. Prior to NCIS, I had stints in the corporate world doing information security. My background was digital forensics. I got a couple of degrees doing that. I was also in academia for a little bit, did coursework and teaching classes to criminal justice students and information security students about open source intelligence techniques. And then I was a Marine Corps infantry scout. I was an 0352. I was the guy who was the 0311s were always jealous about because I got to ride in the Humvees. but yeah, so I, 01 to 05, infantry scout. I enlisted just shortly after 9/11. I was in 1st Tank Battalion in Shiny 29 Palms, California. Where the heck is 29 Palms, California, as they say? We loved it, by the way. 29 Palms is great for us. And I did two combat tours in Iraq. So pushed up to Baghdad during the initial phase in 2003, at the initial phase of the war. Then again in Fallujah during the first battle there in 2004 in March.
Awesome. Well, gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here. And I think that it's a little bit of an embarrassing admission that we are 91 episodes in as of this recording. And this is the first time that we're going to focus on Intel. And I think that let's go ahead and publicly apologize to all the Intel folks out there that you're too important to have waited till episode 91. And I think this is also the first time that we have had two members of a C-suite on at the same time, though the fact checkers on Twitter may tell me that I'm wrong on that, but I think it is. And also two like kick-ass Marine vets. So just thanks so much for being here, guys, and looking forward to diving in a little more on this. But interestingly enough, you guys are running Intel that is not done by the military, but done by a civilian organization, right?
Correct.
That's the distinction here. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll start things off. Jason, in your intro, you talked about going from active duty, then to EyeSight, and then to Intel 471. And you talked a little bit about, hey, there wasn't really cyber in the Marine Corps. Was there a specific problem in your head when you did that, though, and said, I got to go civilian and work on this specific thing? Or did you kind of let the tide take you?
You know, I reached a point, look, I had a great time in my just about 12 years on active duty. A lot of my success, I can link back to that 11 and a half or so years. In the CI human world or the counterintelligence human intelligence world, loved it. TSCM, loved it as well. There's a little bit of a cyber component, but really my passion was on the cyber side. That's all I did in my free time. I taught myself how to code. Back then, I was using Perl. I don't know if anybody uses Perl anymore, unless you're an old school InfoSec kind of person.
It has its place, but yeah.
Yeah, Python. You know, so I did all this in my free time, and I just had this passion and this itch that I needed to scratch. And that's kind of where that's what moved me out of active duty. And I just felt that, you know, at the time, you know, I was doing TSCM missions where, you know, for lack of a better word, I'm looking for bugs, looking for digital transceivers, AM/FM, you know, receivers, whatever, in concrete in a building that's, you know, I don't know, 80 years old, but there's 10 computers sitting in the same room, which is, you know, pretty much a circuit connected to, you know, other computers around the world. And we weren't spending a lot of time on that. And that's where I wanted to spend my time. So, you know, just coincidentally, what ended up happening is my company commander had a relationship or an old friend that was at the FBI as a contractor. And this specific unit was tracking cyber criminals, doing network forensics, doing intrusion analysis, both nation state and financially motivated as well. And I was in Okinawa. They set up this, I mean, I guess you could call it a boondoggle if we're being technical.
It was a boondoggle.
Yeah. So they sent these folks over to Okinawa, and because I was the more technical kind of cyber, you know, the cyber guys, a lot of people used to call me, my team, we had a small 4 or 5 man team at the time. We hosted them and did a technical exchange. Well, I ended up turning that. Look, I never burn bridges. I think I can count on one hand how many bridges I've burned. I'm always networking and creating relationships and maintaining those. They came back for 3 years in a row, and I ended up creating a conference, a cyber conference, like a mini DEF CON, military DEF CON in Okinawa kind of deal, where I went to Kadena Air Base and got I don't know how I pulled this off to this day, but I ended up getting a whole like conference, not a conference room, it was like a auditorium, and did a bunch of talks. And at the end of it, the third year, I'd done 3 talks myself on different cyber things that I'd been doing in my free time. And at the end of it, they came up and they said, hey, you know, are you looking for a job potentially? I said, well, funny enough, I have a stack of resumes here and I got about 6 months left to go and I got 90 days of terminal. So that was my kind of, you know, I just wanted to scratch an itch and I had a passion for this, but I also thought it was a problem that wasn't being looked at close enough. And later, you know, we'll probably get into some of the financially motivated cybercrime and how it was overlooked, in my opinion, over the years to now it's finally accepted as a national security issue. So I think it's kind of come full circle finally.
Yeah, and that's something we have discussed a little bit on the previous casts, believe it or not, kind of the financial side of this. And some of these, as I know you know, are ginormous. So there's definitely a lot there. Before we move on, though, I did want to also ask you. So we talked about transitioning from active duty to other opportunities, but you also moved from EyeSight to found Intel 471. Could you talk us through, like, why do that? And what kind of insights did you glean from that process? Because I would imagine, as with standing up any military unit, there's always rounds you want to have back or interesting things you've learned. So what can we tell the listeners that might help them if they're looking to do the same type of thing?
Yeah, I mean, at first, there's a timing component as well. This industry was really just getting going. And I think there was just a handful of us that had deep Intel backgrounds, but also deep cyber backgrounds as well. So, you know, I was with a small company called Crucial Security at the FBI, and I had done another boondoggle with the Australian Federal Police. And I met my business partner and really good friend, Mark Arena, and we had the same outlook. You know, I had been pulled into this case at the FBI that lasted a number of years, and all of the probably 100 or 120 top cyber criminals in the Eastern Europe and Russia and other parts of the world were all on this one chat server. And I was this kind of focal point for analyzing that data. And I started to see all the human components of cybercrime, right? I mean, they were dealing with the human elements of like having kids and, you know, dealing with just needing money or, you know, spouses or whatever, all that plus the technical side. And that's where my human intelligence, I think, background and then the cyber background kind of merged. And I started to see an opportunity here that really not a lot of folks were really kind of, I think, oriented towards. Everybody was really focused on the technical component, which typically happens after the incident when you get that visibility a lot of times. And Mark had the same, he was Australian Federal Police, and he had the same kind of outlook. So we landed at EyeSight Partners, which was the first, what I think, first traditional cyber threat intelligence company in this space as this industry was just getting going. And we built out a global research team. It really was a global intelligence team, intelligence capability. We were doing technical stuff. We were doing human intelligence, more virtual, sometimes not virtual. So it was really interesting. We had to set up, you know, everything I learned from the Marines and in the Intel world, like, how do you manage that? How do you kind of keep everybody aligned to, you know, a single mission? That all came in handy. And, you know, at what point did I really decide to do my own thing? You know, we saw this transition in this industry where a lot of the big financials were hiring traditional analysts from the military, from the government. They were building traditional intelligence teams. And that would later spread to all the other industries as we see it today. But really, it was centered around the finance, the financial side at the time. But what we knew that the lawyers, whether it's just they're too risk averse within these big companies or it's a skill thing, they were never going to do what we were doing. They were going to do the analytic piece, but they were never going to engage with cyber criminals directly. They were never going to you know, do all the kind of ops and stuff that we were doing, building the teams and stuff. So we said, hey, we can build a company that basically sells subscriptions to that intelligence and that data. So we started our own company and we did it. And, you know, we weren't business guys. We were very much practitioners at heart. And I think in a lot of ways that is a big part of our success as a company.
All right. So Jason, I'm going to massively oversimplify and paraphrase. It seems the key to getting the motivation to start your own business is a pair of really good boondoggles in Okinawa. Just to make sure that we're all on the same page on that. Okay. I fully agree for the record. I want to double click a little bit on the starting a business as a practitioner, and especially as starting a business as a Marine. I think that we've had a number of entrepreneurs on the cast, and I think it's always really good to pick your brain a little bit on this concept. But how do you feel that Marine Corps culture influences your company culture today, like for the good and for the bad to some extent, especially when you were starting out? Like, did you feel any pressure to like demilitarize your sort of the culture that you want to start the company with? Or is everyone in your crew basically a veteran of law enforcement or the military in some way, shape, or form? And so you kind of don't need to do that. In fact, the opposite. We're always interested in getting this feedback.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I think there's just a happy medium that I like to lean towards, you know, what I learned in the Marine Corps and the things that were kind of instilled in me. Because I think it's really important to have kind of a culture of accountability, a very kind of tactful but brutal honesty, a culture that kind of embraces the fact that you can call things out when they need to be called out because the mission requires it. You know, so all of that kind of stuff that was instilled, I think kind of it creates the foundation of the culture. And a lot of that sometimes, you know, you don't always see that in the civilian world. I think just people are inherently, it's tough to be, especially in the West. Sometimes I found it, I've worked with, you know, for the better part of the last, 15, 20 years, you know, I've worked all over the world with teams all over the world. And I find that just being brutally honest, but tactful, of course, is sometimes challenging, but it's definitely a requirement to building a successful business, especially when you're a startup. So all of that stuff I learned, you know, while I was in the Marines, or is instilled in me. And then sometimes it's just inherent into how people are. You just can't fake it to make it, right? So I kind of use the team analogy, team sports analogy a lot. Mike can attest to this. But I think that, you know, I hear some people say, oh, we're a family, and then that's fine. But, you know, I would never fire my mom, right? Maybe my brother, you know, because he pisses me off or something. But no, I'm kidding. If my brother's listening. But I like the team analogy because everybody has a role. Everybody has a mission to win. And at the end of the day, you need to be honest with yourself about where your gaps are and how they're going to get filled. And then you also have to be honest when somebody's not performing and they need to be replaced, because that's what happens. There's a kind of inherent culture of accountability in a team that's trying to win that, hey, if you're not cutting the mustard, you know, you need to be replaced. And that's okay. I mean, that's just the nature of the business. You know, I think a lot of that is stuff that was kind of really instilled in me back through my just about 12 years on active duty.
All right. So Jason, I know you had no way of knowing this going in, but the treat work as a family thing is a really hot button issue for me as well, because there's a great talk that the CEO of Netflix does on the difference between running a business as a family and running a business as a sports team. And I always use the metaphor of running a business as a spec ops team in some way, shape, or form. John, the Reed Hastings is the guy. You can look this up on YouTube. Just do Reed Hastings family talk, I think is what it's summarized as or something. But, you know, when you're running a sports team, you earn your position. And you stay in your position until either someone outperforms you or you get injured and can't perform the task anymore or whatever. And it's a pretty Boolean setup. And I think that when you're operating a high performance organization, you have to operate that way. And the minute that you start to think of your business as a family, what you're inherently saying is that you're allowing emotion and feeling to run the business as opposed to the performance and the goals that you're ending up doing, right? You're not going to lay off your brother or your sister or your mom the same way that you're going to, you know, tell the second baseman in your baseball organization that he's not, you know, throwing the ball fast enough or covering the base hard enough in any way, shape, or form. It's performance based. And I think that levels everybody up from understanding how you work as a team, how you contribute to the bottom line, the mission, whatever metaphor we want to use in this, but love that.
Yeah. And I'll say one more thing, right? So as you build out a company, we have 200 people just about in this company. That's a lot of people that depend on our ability to make decisive, sound decisions, right? Mm-hmm. To pay their bills, to feed their kids, their families. So, you know, if you don't take that serious as an executive, as a CEO, then you're in the wrong business. You're, you know, this is not a place for you. Because that's something that keeps me up at night. And especially in 2023, 2023 has been a challenging year for companies to navigate. And, you know, there's tough decisions that have had to been made, but you do it for, you know, ultimately the better of the company and success of the mission.
Oh, Jason, thanks for that, man. There's a lot of questions I have, but I want to actually turn over to Mike here, because you guys both have amazing backgrounds. So Mike, you know, you had an interesting background as well, you know, from the Marine Corps over to the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, right, then over to Interpol. Did your why as you left active duty kind of match Jason's, or was it different? And how has it helped you leverage your experience at Intel 471?
Yeah, I mean, I would say there are a lot of similarities with our story, or at least the why to why we're doing what we're doing right now and why we maybe made the transition. I think looking back, gosh, this was, you know, Jason, you and Mark had been doing this thing for about 3 years by the time I came on board. For me, when the opportunity arose, it was more about tackling a problem set, building an intelligence team from the ground up. So Jason talked a little bit about timing. Well, this was a timing thing for me. It was like, man, I have an opportunity here really to pull the trigger. Yeah, there's a risk element there to leaving the government. I had just gotten promoted. So I had my whole family in Singapore and a really nice job, all my four girls and my wife. And now I'm taking a contractor position in Texas where we'd never lived before. So, you know, it was very much about having an opportunity in front of me to really do things, which I looked at and said, man, this is something that I'm going to be able to build. It's a unique opportunity to do something for the greater good. You know, a lot of people in the military and in the intel space, especially, they have a broader reach in the mission sets that they do within the government. For me, in my position, it wasn't the case at NCIS. I had quite a narrow mission set that I was focused on. And so there was a kind of a beating desire in my heart to do something a little bit better for the greater good at a greater scale. And so that was really the main impetus for me making the jump. And then it was really only after that that I met Jason. You obviously were part of hiring me and stuff like that, but I didn't know you before. It was only after I was exposed to this opportunity that you and I had met and realized that you were Marine. And I was like, okay, well, this is, you know, it's on now. Like, it's icing on the cake now. I've got a fellow Marine that we're going to tag team this with. And then I realized that, you know, everything that Jason was talking about, building a team with a great culture, you know, I realized that I was crossing paths with Jason and Intel 471 and Mark Arena. It was really a perfect alignment with how I saw the world, how I saw teams being built. It was a perfect sort of combination of all the camaraderie and teamwork that we appreciate in the military and in the Marine Corps, but really none of the bureaucracy that a lot of us have to face, a lot of the red tape, right?
Hoorah to that.
Exactly. So yeah, a similar story in a lot of ways to Jason, at least the why, but also just a little bit different in the timing aspect of it.
Yeah. So Mike, I have one question I do want to ask you, because, you know, you both kind of, both you and Jason talked about like passion and having, you know, enough being not risk adverse yourself to kind of jumping into a new career path. I mean, leaving the amazingness that is Singapore and then going to Texas, not that Texas is bad, is a jump. But I did just want to ask you one question. So, you know, operationalizing intelligence, I think both John and I can attest to this after our last tour of duty. When you have an amazing intelligence team, man, life is good. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that, and here's my question, it's kind of around, you know, without giving up tradecraft pieces here, but like just around managing the intel cycle on a second to second basis, right? So my question for you is like, when you meet with customers, right, and they do they come and ask like, hey, you know, Mandiant or, you know, FireEye or CrowdStrike will give me this threat feed and I'll subscribe to it and it'll come in an automated fashion. You guys seem to do something way more, you know, tailored to your customer. Could you talk about that just a little bit without giving up too much of the tradecraft and your secret sauce?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good question. I would say that, you know, when I came on board, we had a research team that was doing what we call boots on the ground cyber human collection. So we were really, really, really doing a great job on the collection, the tactical collection side. We didn't have an analyst team, like a headquartered, doctrinally focused intelligence analyst team that was sort of distilling all of that collection into finished intelligence that then can be operationalized and clients can then use it to understand different trends and stuff like that. So really, it was my task to come on board and build that and kind of faced with the decision, well, do I go out and find a bunch of cybersecurity SMEs who really know the cybersecurity space, or do we build this from the ground up using a more classical intelligence approach, finding analysts that maybe don't have the subject matter expertise in the financially motivated cyberspace, but they understand intelligence doctrine, they understand analytical standards, and they understand estimated probability language and all of these things. And so we did the latter. We built the analytical team with people from the military and the government who have intelligence backgrounds, and we sort of taught them the subject matter domain. So the result of that is that you have consistent standards that we use in our style guides for what we report. Clients, when they read a report today, they're going to see the same kind of style and the same kind of language and estimated probabilities that they will see tomorrow. And so it builds confidence in what they're reading. When we assess things, we'll say if, you know, high confidence, low confidence, medium confidence, and they're going to be able to use that and arm themselves to take whatever action or make whatever decision they need to. And so one of our mottos here is we want to be the voice of reason and truth. So we might be a little bit late on a sort of a flashy headline grabbing topic that's everybody else is talking about. But when we come out and we say something about it, it's going to be very rich and robust, and it's going to have some actionable insights attached to it because we've taken the time and we have the methodology that we've built over time to be able to produce something like that that's actually going to be useful. It's not just waving the flag and saying, hey, we have something to say about it, right? There's enough of that going on.
Yeah, and you know, I do want to just add one thing. Going back to about risk-taking, you know, one thing I point out in the company a lot, I always go back to Mike when he joined from Singapore. He left NCIS living in Singapore. He had four girls, and Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, between the ages of about 3 and 13 at the time. Is that about right? Yeah,
that's about right. Something like that.
To take a contractor position. We had no employees at the time, guys. We had just contractors because we were just still building the business. And he moved to Salina, Texas, which is like, I don't know, 40 miles north of Dallas, little like the town on the outer skirts of northern part of DFW. So yeah, it's all about risk taking. And then also just to add on what Mike was saying, you know, look, we've built these teams around these different countries. You know, I've been working in Romania, Ukraine, down in Brazil, you know, even, you know, Taiwan, and I had a team in China at one time. And what we did is we actually used, going back to the Marine Corps, we actually leveraged the generic intelligence requirements handbook, which MCIA used to put out, but they probably still do. And I would carry one of those everywhere I went as a human collector. We used that as the kind of spirit of how we managed both our current intel kind of collections and how we keep everybody aligned and how we do KPIs, but also now our customers are leveraging that framework we've created. We call it the CUGR. They leverage it as well to manage their internal intel operations.
Yes, and that brings me right to what I wanted to bring up here. So in the show notes for this episode, I've got links to your YouTube series on your CUGR as well as the CUGR itself. So dear listeners, you can just hop into the show notes and you can pull both of these things up. But Mike, I wanted to ask a pointed question here. So one of the things that I'm kind of thinking as I'm listening to you is I love the human. I love the kind of like personal relationship based touch that you're bringing to this. But maybe what might be on someone's mind is this repeatable? Is there a process behind it? And the answer is obviously yes. And the YouTube series will go through all of that. Could you TLDR that for us? Like what does the CUGR give us? And how does that lead to repeatable results?
Yeah. First of all, I can get on soapbox about this. I got to be careful because I came from the military, which for you Intel bubbas out there, everything that you do in the military, it's all based on requirements of your stakeholders, right? If you are not collecting and producing Intel that aligns with your stakeholder needs, you're basically finger in the wind, hoping that you're going to be successful. So I come into this, I come from that into the commercial private space. And you see a lot of vendors basically saying that they align their efforts off of stakeholders' requirements. You start, pulling the thread on that. There's really nothing there. So we made it our mission from the get-go to say, listen, in order for us to be able to scale this thing out, we need to be able to align our efforts across the board from our tactical collection to our finished intel to the needs of our stakeholders. And we need to do it in a real way that's measurable, and we need to be able to prove it. I call it it's not Paula Abdul, it's the Janet Jackson, I think. What have you done for me lately? Conversation.
Yes.
Someone better not start singing.
Way to keep it pop culture for us.
Thank you very much. It showed my age a little bit. But it's the ROI conversation that we have with our clients. Hey, this is what we've collected and produced based on that align with your top 10 PIRs. And to do this at scale, you need some sort of framework. And so we built the framework that Jason's talking about right now, which is inspired by the Marine Corps GER. And this is something that my team, every week we get together, every Tuesday is a collaboration call, we call it. And all the teams across the functional areas in my department, we even have people across the other areas in our sales, marketing, they join this call. And at the very top of the call, it's all about, hey, let's look at all of the PIRs that are aggregated for all of our customers, where are we seeing gaps? So it's gap analysis. Where are we seeing gaps? What do we need to be focused on this week? What do we need to be focused on long-term to be able to fill those gaps and satisfy our client needs? And then obviously our client-facing collection managers then take those results and bring them to our clients so that there's a what have I done for you lately conversation.
And Mike, I have to guess because I believe every Intel professional I have ever worked with my entire career, the probably number one challenge for them is normally not the actual Intel and the doing of the Intel. It's almost always getting the customer, which we will say the command, just to kind of militarize this, getting the command to completely understand the Intel cycle, how it works, how they fit in. Are they asking and putting forth their most salient questions, thoughts, and operational outcomes? I have to assume this problem has been brought to you and that both of you, it's probably very near and dear to your heart. Are there any techniques you use to help them with Intel stakeholder management and engagement?
Yeah, it's a perennial challenge in the public and private sectors for sure. There's a couple of things, I always tell, so we actually do a workshop on this. It's a free workshop that people can sign up for. It's about a half a day long. It's virtual. I'm going to go through the process of basically standing up Intel requirements using our GIR handbook. So we talk about eliciting requirements from stakeholders. And how do you do that when you've got stakeholders who don't really understand Intel? A lot of it is about rapport building and investing in the time to build that relationship with your stakeholder. I always say that SOC analysts like coffee too. So take them out for coffee, invest in that relationship because that's how you're going to get your return. And that's how you're going to get ultimately the feedback, the qualitative feedback that you're looking for to be able to fine tune your offering to them. And then, I get asked the question a lot, like, my stakeholder just doesn't know what I do. They don't know what I can give them. And so, what we do is we offer, hey, that's okay. We're going to help you. We have a list of, pre-baked PIRs for you that are based on maybe your industry or your geo. And let's just use this as a starting point. And this is a starting point for a conversation that we can have to maybe this is the top 10 that we've proposed. Maybe this, this makes it to the final list. Maybe we take it and we tweak it based on the conversation, but just give them something so that you can work off of. Those are two very practical things that I think you can start with to help with the challenge of eliciting requirements from stakeholders. Maybe need a little bit of help.
Yeah, I think that's great. And then my other follow-up question was, it sounds like in general, the thing that's really novel about what you're doing is you're taking Q-mentors and either grabbing them that have domain knowledge through other experiences like the two of you had, or it sounded like you talked through kind of teaching them through domain knowledge. Do you take other types of backgrounds, or do you try to kind of keep it to the Humint family? And could you talk through what the challenges around that kind of domain knowledge is? Is it harder to take someone domain knowledge and teach them the Intel cycle, or vice versa? What's your experience there?
I mean, I'll just say that a diverse workforce with diverse backgrounds and experiences is definitely the way to go. We've had, you know, as Jason said, we've really started the company with the backbone of a lot of law enforcement, security services, people who've done this in the government, who understand the subject matter, who understand how to track Russian language cyber criminals because they speak the language natively. But over time, as we've built this out, you know, we've hired people from journalism backgrounds, right? Who know how to tell a story, because it's one thing to be able to collect really, you know, good, unique, exclusive intel, but it's a whole nother thing to be able to articulate the value of why is this important to you, and also, you know, prescriptive intelligence about, well, what can you do with this intel? So people who understand language really well, like journalists, they can really round out a good intel team. Also, we've hired people with psychology degrees directly out of academia who understand the psyche of threat actors that we're tracking. So there's a, you know, technical people who understand malware. There's really just, you know, as a manager and as a leader and someone who builds teams, really identifying, you know, and spotting gaps and opportunities where you can fill necessary skills and experiences with.
Hey, Mike, can I double click on that with you? Because something in the last couple of years is I've been, I've hired many, many people in the last 4 or 5 years, and more than I've, like, exponentially more than I'd ever done in the previous years before that. But I've generally found that hiring people with psychology backgrounds, journalist backgrounds, or people who have worked in healthcare, like people who, like, with nursing backgrounds or triage backgrounds or 911 dispatch type things, that has been the most incredible collection of different perspectives and resources from just a work experience perspective. And I almost, and no one quote me on this, even though we're recording it on a podcast, obviously, I would say that those folks can adapt to anything. Like, there is not a job on the planet that someone with a psychology degree, a journalism degree, or has worked in 911 dispatch response or been a healthcare provider cannot do. It's limitless potential.
Totally. Adaptability, flexibility, which I guess is the same thing, but also curiosity, because this space is evolving faster than I can even think, right? So we need people in this space, and this is not just our company. This is people in this industry, in the cyber threat intel industry. We need people who are not afraid to be curious and not afraid to ask questions, and who people who are go-getters, like execution-oriented, people who know who to reach out to because they don't have all the answers and aren't afraid to reach out to that person. So those are the kind of underlying, like, traits that we're looking for, aside from, you know, whether they can rip apart malware or not. I can really find any, you know, there's a lot of people who can rip apart malware, right? There's a lesser amount of people who can rip apart malware, but then also can explain why it's important and also can understand, you know,
Tell the story.
Tell the story, mm-hmm. and talk with the researchers about why it makes sense to them. So those are the kind of people that we're looking for, people with high curiosity and who are mission oriented.
Yeah, and I think I'll add a component, a business side to this that I think is, you know, I love reminiscing about this, is, you know, Mike's telling these, you know, these stories and what he's done and what we've done. And I think back to, I think it's 2015, I'm outside of Kyiv, you know, with 10 of 12 people in the entire company at the time. And I told everybody, hey, look, you know, at some point in the future, we're going to look back. I want you to remember this moment, because we're going to be, you know, 25 people, 50 people, 75 people. And, you know, lo and behold, we're like almost 200 people. We got, you know, we went through an acquisition with Thoma Bravo, one of the top, you know, private equity firms in the world. And you look at kind of what they look at from a business perspective when they're looking at companies, they're looking for diamonds in the rough. And Intel is inherently tough to scale. It just is. If you look at our margins, we're in the 70%+ margins. And to do that with Intel, you know, selling Intel subscriptions is to me pretty crazy. and to see how we've built, you know, we went from the 75, I thought we'd never get by 75 people, to almost 200 people when we did that deal. And now we're doing it again, and we're scaling it even bigger. I mean, to do that in a traditional Intel world, I think, you know, is pretty interesting and pretty, pretty interesting.
And I'll say, as someone who works in a services and SaaS-based world as well, for those of you listeners who are still active duty or don't have exposure to this, 70% margins is friggin' bonkers. You know, you don't get more than that until you have a completely repeatable add-to-cart SaaS product. That is the pinnacle of what is achievable, and that's pretty darn awesome, Jason.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, Jason, I'll add one thing too, just to kind of dovetail off both you and Kyle, right? Like, so when you talk about scaling, you know, and kind of what Mike talked about before, like finding the niche area that customers want to self-select into, I think is also probably part of your secret sauce with the human-like component that you do for intelligence collection, right? Like, I, to be honest with you, 100%, like, didn't know folks like you guys exist until John introduced me to the fact that we were doing this podcast. Like, it blew my mind. I was like, wait a minute, that's a thing?
I think that means they're doing their job right, though, right?
That's 100%. That's what I mean.
Okay, point, cool.
To your point, Kyle, that's how you get to 70% margins, right? It's not doing the same thing other people do. It's having this like really, really cool thing that's not only cool, but you can monetize it because everybody wants it once they know it's a thing. So anyhow, sorry for riffing off that. I just wanted to double click on like what you guys are doing, I think is amazing. You know, having learned from an intelligence professional how important it is to manage this on a day-to-day basis and kind of have that multi-int approach to, you know, solving problems. So
just a last comment on that, you know, look, I didn't go to Wharton, Mike. I'm pretty sure you didn't go to Harvard or anything like that. And no offense, you know,
just nothing pretty wrong, sure. Just pretty sure.
Why are you saying
nothing
that?
Wrong with
you.
It's because you're a Michigan fan, Mike. Course. I don't know. Something like that.
Oh, there we go.
Okay. But we're practitioners at heart. And I think, and my CMO hates when I say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. I'm sorry, Joy. I really believe that what we have done is we focused on what we know and what we're good at. We're honest and identified and knew what we weren't going to, what we couldn't do, what we weren't prepared to do. And what we accidentally did was built a really good company, purposely built a really good Intel company, accidentally built, when I say a good business, a company, I mean, foundationally, the metrics, you know, that go behind that, you know, when you're talking about margins and all of that. And I think that's kind of what led to, you know, a pretty great outcome and, you know, will happen in the future as well.
All right, guys, with such big brains in the room, I can't let you out of here without doing a little bit of a lightning round Q&A of some predictions going into 2024. As we're recording this on January 3rd, we've just ushered in the new year, and it feels like everything changes every day. Mike, you said it earlier as well. This industry changes so fast. This world changes so fast. So I'm going to put you guys a little bit on the spot here. And Mike, I'm going to start with you. We hear a ton about the skills crunch that exists inside of cybersecurity, inside of all the things related to national security and intelligence and all these sorts of things. Are you seeing that same skills crunch? Are you finding it tougher to find talent in any way? Or do you think that 2024 is going to be an increasing growth year for you and that talent acquisition is going to be you choosing?
Yeah, man. I mean, this topic certainly ebbs and flows. It has over the past 5 or 6 years since I've been in the private sector. I don't know if we're dealing here, you know, at Intel 471 with a talent crunch. When we open up positions, we tend to get certainly a good number of applicants, and of those applicants, they're pretty high quality. So I don't know, Jason. I mean, what are your thoughts? I mean, I know we go through a pretty rigorous hiring process, especially for our Intel department folks.
Yeah.
What do you think on your side?
No, I think that's been pretty much the same, you know, as we built this company. And I don't know why exactly that is, but we do get a very high quality and high number of applicants. And I think what kind of slows us down sometimes is we're very, very particular because, you know, we're not looking just for the skills and the technical skills and the experience. you know, we're also looking for that culture fit as well, like very, very important to us. So, you know, we're probably lucky in this regard, because, you know, I think that it is a real issue. Why we don't see it as much, you know, it could be something with the brand we've kind of built and the company we've built, and people just seem to want to work here. I hope that's what it is.
All right. Well, sounds great. All right. Next question. Mike, I'm going to kick it to you first on this one as well. We've gotten through this entire podcast, I think, without saying AI once. So now that I've said AI twice, I have to say AI three times, and now we can all move on with our lives. But AI is changing everything. That's what you hear. That's what you read. That's what we see everywhere. How are you seeing the proliferation of new tools and capabilities impacting the threat intelligence world?
So I had my stopwatch on here because I was just waiting for this question. I mean, we can't get away without talking about AI. Yep. So, you know, it's an interesting one. Everyone's talking about it, and I think rightly so. We're, of course, you know, at Intel 471, tracking it through the lens of how, you know, how threat actors are trying to leverage the technology, AI, ML, for badness. There's a lot of, you know, we're talking about this quite a lot here internally within the teams, and there's a lot of hypothetical use cases out there for how threat actors might start using these technologies. I think it's, you know, the consensus from the team here is that it's just difficult. It's too early to tell which ones will sort of emerge as, you know, the most realistic, the most impactful. This technology is relatively new to threat actors as it is for the industry. So they're just trying to kind of figure it out. They're human beings behind a keyboard as well. They're trying to figure out how to best use it. That being said, I think there are a few kind of to be on the lookout for on the horizon. Actors are trying to figure out how to use these tools for, you know, like low level social engineering attacks, phishing campaigns where they can impersonate, you know, some of the attacks where they impersonate legitimate people to get around authentication checks, where they're, you know, so think of a scenario where you're a threat actor, you've cloned a victim's voice, and now you're using it to call their bank, and you're bypassing automated authentication workflows. Like that's some pretty scary stuff. And there's also the notion that actors could use chatbots for ransomware negotiations. So you can imagine a situation where they've got chatbots, they initiate a chatbot, they don't have to have somebody behind a computer.
Oh, yeah, it's a great way to scale, lower your labor costs.
I mean, yeah. yeah, you can just ransomware at scale using chatbots, right? So that better scales their enterprise and their ability to impact ransomware victims at a larger scale than ever had before. I think what is going to be more common is probably the use of AI ML for the more mundane backend tasks that threat actors are doing, you know, as opportunity cost saving measures. So, you know, these are financially motivated actors, right? They're for profit.
Yep.
They're looking for easy, quick ways to earn a profit. So, you know, using AI tools, ML tools to sort through masses of stolen data to find juicy targets, you know, construct believable social engineering campaigns, emails, right, in a single mouse click, they're going to look for those opportunities to make their lives easier while making the same or even increased profit with a limited amount of work. So that, I think that's where we're at with the AI ML scene.
Awesome. All right, Jason, I'm coming over to you for this next one. Do you think that the current and or future state of cyber regulation, and I'm going to push that into the intelligence community, has an impact for you or other threat intelligence companies?
Yeah, I think it does. It's always something that you need to navigate. I mean, very much like any industry that has regulation, you know, when it comes to PII or any kind of, you know, personal information that might pop up, you got to deal with that. I think where we've kind of navigated it and where we've done well, I mean, when you're building a business, you know, we operate where you can quickly be in a gray area, right? And even beyond the gray area, you can quickly kind of go into those realms. But, you know, we've built, you don't build a scalable business actively doing those kind of things. So what we've done is, you know, the DOJ has issued guidance. We leverage that guidance as part of our way of working. We have a internal kind of code of conduct, if you will, for all of our Intel folks across the company, and they adhere to that. So I think the other thing that helps us too is a lot of the folks that we have, the backgrounds, you know, they just bring kind of a moral compass, if you will. The mission is about getting the bad guys not to do bad guy things. And that helps a lot too, that kind of culture, part of the culture. So that's what we've done. But it'll constantly be something that as a business, you have to navigate for sure.
Okay. And then I'm going to end this by taking that and sort of using it as a tee up for you again, Jason, which we are seeing a massive evolution across the entire field right now in state-sponsored versus non-state-sponsored cyber activity. Do you feel that the financial cybercrime and the things that happen in the world today, do you think those are things that government and nation states should be responsible for and take action of, or do you think that's still a civil issue?
I think it's now a national security issue, so I don't know if there's really a choice. You know, there's really two revelations that I think have happened over the last, probably the last 2 years. First is that financially motivated cybercrime is now a national security issue. You know, the rise of ransomware that culminated in Colonial Pipeline attack, I think really got the folks on the public sector side in the, you know, the governments to realize this is national security issue. This is something that some of us have watched for years go from $500 ransoms to multi-million dollar ransoms, and just seeing this kind of snowball over time just continue. And finally, I feel that we've seen it as a national security issue. The other one that over the other thing I think we've seen, and that is finally getting some, you know, notice, I think, is that there's this blurring of the lines between cybercrime world, the financially motivated cybercrime world, and the nation state kind of world. You know, if you take the SolarWinds incident, you know, that was massively impactful, largely to believe solely nation state, you know, oriented. I can tell you right now, we were tracking the actor probably a year or so before that happened, and he was selling the access as a cyber criminal. And in what we know and what we have seen, it was sold to FIS, Foreign Intel Services. So that kind of stuff is happening. There's tons of examples that Mike could probably speak to, because we're bumping into those folks on not a regular basis, but it's not uncommon.
Yeah, I mean, if I could just add, I mean, this is something that I don't think gets talked about a lot. The nexus of cybercrime, nation state, it's a daily thing. I mean, this is happening on a daily basis. It's more common than most people think it is. And it really, if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, they like to say that they're hiding in the noise. These entities that are working on behalf of, at the behest of, inspired by nation states, they're hiding in the noise. Why build something, whether it be malware, infrastructure, whatever, when you can simply take it off the shelf, buy it, rent it, and then hide the noise? You got plausible deniability, right? So, and it's not just, you know, we talk about Russia a lot, and they're definitely, you know, Russian language actors have basically built the cybercrime underground the way it is today. And Russia, as an administration, uses the cyberground underground to lurk and do the things that they do. But it's not just Russia. I mean, North Korea, Lazarus Group, you know, using prolific money mule herders to launder their funds for their crypto heists over the years. You know, going back to Russia, we saw with the Conti leaks, I guess this was about 18 months ago now, we saw in those leaked chat logs, they were at least some components of their sort of well-oiled enterprise was operating at the behest of the Russian government. So this is not it's not going away anytime soon. If you look closely, you can see it.
Yeah. And I'll add one last thing to that. You know, what we see on a regular basis, you see cyber criminals that have been co-opted. So they're allowed to operate, but guess what? One day they're going to get the tap on the shoulder. So we see that. We've seen moonlighters. So we know that there are cyber criminals that do kind of both, and they'll leverage what they've done on the nation state side. They'll leverage that on the cybercrime side, and then straight up FIS that operates in these areas as well. Foreign intel services, you know, that will operate in these areas as well directly. So we've seen all three of those.
Well, Mike, Jason, thanks. Going through that lightning round with Kyle was amazing. So I can't help but riff off that for 1 second. I promise to be short here because I know we're getting close on time and John's got some last minute questions for you, but I believe, I know you guys probably believe, and we've seen this from the highest levels of our government, that partnerships are key to winning, right? Just in general. And Jason, you talked about it with your networking comments and not burning bridges. And you can think about how many times on one hand that you didn't, you know, that you did that. So with your experience on both sides of the fence, public and private, Mike, how do you think public-private partnerships, you know, specifically with the government in relation to threat intel, could be improved to, you know, kind of inform operations in either increased defense or lethality? I mean, this is a perfect kind of jump from your comments on, you know, this is a national security problem, right? Moving forward. So any thoughts on that, on how to improve kind of from a public-private partnership perspective?
Well, I can tell you from a business perspective that one thing that could improve it is just making it easier to do business with the government. It is exceptionally hard sometimes, to the point where it can impact your business, especially when you're a company like ours. We don't have a massive department. We're doing very impactful stuff, very useful stuff that, you know, the governments could use, and have good success. But we don't have the inroads, or we don't have the way to get the deals in place. So that's a huge roadblock. As much as I would love to share everything as an Intel company, you know, it's all about us knowing things that nobody knows, or knowing way faster than everybody knows. You know, that's the business model, kind of like in a nutshell, right? So to give it away, it's not good for, you know, keeping people happy internally. So there has to be a happy medium between that. So I think that if you make it easier for folks like us to do business with the government, and then the other stuff will come with the more freely sharing. We have a lot of government customers. We've got that in place. And we have really good relationships that go beyond what you see in our platform. So I think that's where the magic happens. Once you've got, we're a business, we've got to run the business, we've got to build a business. But once you have those deals in place and you can build those relationships, then the sharing beyond what is just the general product can happen.
Yes.
And if I could just add just one quick thing on the operational side, sorry to cut you off. Really what we've seen makes the magic happen between public-private sector partnerships, because as Jason said, we have a very robust relationship with a number of Five Eyes entities, right? It's about two things. It's about access and speed. So government has tons of great access in how they're able to collect things that, you know, the private sector is not, but the opposite is also true. So our native language speakers and access that we're able to gain and glean from those people who've been doing this for a long time, and the speed at which we can collect that information and deliver it is something that our public sector partners really rely on us for.
Yeah, Mike. So Jason, Mike, one, thank you for answering that. Two, I'll just say this much. I was reading a Forbes article earlier today that just talked about having some optimism moving forward on the government side, like the government just being a better customer, right, to business with. And I think you see now, you know, the administration, hopefully this carries forward, you know, through the different elections that'll happen here in 2024. But just this focus on defense industrial base policy, right, and figuring out how to get leaner and meaner with our private sector partners, so that like Team USA, and to your point about the Five Eye partners, Team Alliance, it is winning the game. So thank you for those comments. John, over to you.
So Jason, Mike, either one of you wants to take this or both. I would kick myself if I didn't ask you to address nation state. I know those two words elicit a response regardless of who you are. I imagine you have thoughts. Anything you want to riff off that?
Going back to what I said, you know, previously, you know, in the spaces that we cover, why wouldn't nation states be active? So I think it's just, you have to, you know, recognize that and accept that. Somebody can go in there and buy an access into a target that, you know, for who knows, $50,000, $100,000, that these are pennies to most governments that, you know, if they had to develop an op and run it, they've got plausible deniability, and then they have a partner as well. You know, they can build kind of relationships. I think when it comes to nation state, that blurring of the lines has just been so steady over the last 10, 15 years. And I think a lot of people still don't accept it or recognize it. They can't imagine that, you know, some of these big things you've read about in the news from a nation state perspective originated in this underground marketplace where cyber criminals are kind of buying and selling, you know, malware and stolen credit cards and stuff like that and accesses. So, you know, that's what I would say to that. Mike?
Yeah, I mean, not too much more to add other than just keep in mind, you know, nation state tends to be a buzzword. It's not binary. It's not if you're a nation state or if you're not. You know, you have certain hacktivist groups, for instance, that claim to be operating at the behest of a nation state when in fact they're just ideologically aligned. They're not working. They're not given infrastructure and provided tooling to do their stuff. And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, you have, you know, threat actors who are absolutely, you know, working in the same building as you know, the military that they operate from within that nation state hostile country. So just keep that in mind when you say nation state in the news. It's not always what you think it is, perhaps.
Kyle, it is that time. Hit us with your hot take.
All right. So I think my hot take is going to be general because I think we've done a lot of interesting things on this cast, but build companies for teams and not families. And the more diverse and diverse experience that you can apply to that team, the better off and more effective you're going to be in every single situation. If I can't stress that enough, this is hitting on topics that I'm having to address in my day job and day life all the time as well. And just want to stress that as much as I possibly can.
And a successful company is just a series of boondoggles.
That's yeah. Right. In Okinawa. Correct. It's important to know. That's right.
Yeah. That was an unfortunate omission, Kyle.
I'm so sorry. Jason, you're officially hired as the third host of this podcast now. I got to step back. It's time.
Jason's doing boondoggles in Okinawa, and I'm doing boondoggles in 29 Palms, California.
Well, it's good to know that everyone here is also a fellow resident of 29 Palms in some way, shape, or form. I spent many years there. You know, I have the Lake Bandini swim team shirt still in my closet, so it's all good.
Love it.
Rich, knife hands, where are they at?
Yeah. So, John, I don't know if this is a knife hand moment or just like a Rich is super inspired after listening to both Mike and Jason talk. But I just wanted to say, you know, if you're a security professional, whether you're wearing a uniform, whether you're a government civilian or a contractor, or you're working for awesome, you know, employers like Jason and Mike, you can have a positive impact globally as a security professional, because this is a whole of nation and whole of alliance game to the you know, guests talking points about nation states and who's aligned with who. And then I also just want to say, you know, to quote, I guess, quote General Mattis, right? Like, keep attacking, right? Keep attacking, manage your intel cycle, seek people like Jason and Mike. If you don't know how to do that, they're there. That's what the public-private partnership thing is for. And keep winning. So that's all I got, John.
Thanks, Rich. Hey, Strange, we just got a listener email. It says, John, did you watch a football game on Monday? Why, yes, I did. The University of Michigan is headed to the national championship. Yes, yes, yes. Dear listeners, thank you for joining us. You can connect with us on social media by going to Twitter and following at @USMC_TFPHOENIX. That's @USMC_TaskForcePhoenix. Our editor is Sarah Clarkson, and marketing support is provided by Jake Osborne. You can support the cast by going to Apple Podcasts and leaving us a 5-star review with accompanying comment. And with that, we are out.
Go Blue?
Go Blue.